Hi, I'm Tony Riddle, and this is the Nat Life Pod, a platform for conversation to help close the gap between wellness as an industry and wellness as a state of being. Big shout out to this episode's sponsor, XL Coffee. XL are renowned organic coffee producers here in the UK who have gone to extraordinary lengths to ensure their coffee is mold-free and has kept its antioxidant potency. XL are waking up the world of coffee. I'm a big fan and recommend you go give them a try. Use discount code NatLifePod at checkout. Details are in the show notes. I believe when experience and knowledge have a baby, we call that baby wisdom. Introducing my wise mate, Grace Kingswell, to the Nat Life Pod. Grace is a nutritional therapist, specialising in fertility and gut health, with a keen interest in everything to do with babies and children. Grace is hugely qualified and incredibly passionate about her field, and having healed herself through nutrition and lifestyle speaks to her practice from a real place of knowing. Now, as we're unpacking a fair amount of information on nutrition and lifestyle here, it can feel a little triggering. So my advice for maintaining a beginner's mind is, like with all things upregulating, slow your breathing down to around 6 nasal breaths per minute and extend those exhales. I hope you enjoy the chat as much as we did. Grace.
Cheers.
Chicking. It's been a while since you and I have been behind mics. When was that pod?
I think you came on my podcast. Well, we were still living in London. Maybe like 4 years ago. Do you think? As much as that?
Had I?
We've been in Cornwall for about three.
It feels longer than that.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. I'd gauge it about. I was thinking 5 years, but yeah, that might be like 2019.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. Lots changed. And then you guys came down when you were house hunting and stayed with us in Cornwall.
Yeah.
And now you're here in our Airbnb. And now I just drove literally 5 minutes down the road and I'm here.
We are neighbours. Incredible.
Yeah, I know.
It's so good.
It is good. Cornwall is good. It's not, I mean, it's been a tough winter, I think, for lots of us, but Cornwall especially has been very wet and very miserable.
Yeah, it's been
hard.
We will discuss food later, I guess, but the food systems, and I was at Cuscarn yesterday and Greg was saying, well, actually it's been a really tough time for farming because it's been saturated the whole land, right?
Yeah.
And the impact that's going to then have on those food systems.
For sure.
But we're all going to get hit by it at some stage. But
yeah, and I think the whole of the UK is just getting wetter. I mean, the world is like getting wetter, isn't it? With temperatures rising and we're having kind of milder winters, but wetter winters.
Yeah.
So I just need to mentally, like, I just need to be resilient to that.
Embrace that. Or just embrace that. The winter.
Disappear for the winter, yeah. That's the key. We were in Australia for a whole month, but that was not long enough. And then you come home and you're like, oh, within a few days, it's like you were never away, which is quite sad. But yeah.
Yeah, my assistant, Steph, she'd go away over the winter. She'd be down in Cornwall for many years. And when we first moved here, I was like, why do you go away so much over the winter? She said, Tony, just wait until you've been here for a couple of years and you'll feel it. I get it.
Yeah.
I think even just dipping out for 2 weeks would be something.
You can't, Tony, because your whole thing is, you know, we've got to embrace the uncomfortable. So
leaning to discomfort. And there's no such thing as bad weather, just inappropriate clothing. Yeah. There's also an inappropriate, you know, perception towards it, I guess. So there is that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, and we're also a big family unit. So it's not like we're totally isolated and suffering from not having our social needs met.
Totally. And also to take a family of your size across the other side of the world in the middle of winter is fucking expensive.
I was invited and I really wanted to go. It was my friend's wedding, Seth. His place is 42 acres right in Somerset. And he and Renata were getting married and they sent an invite and it was for South Africa and I really wanted to go. And it was an invite for the whole family. And when I looked at flights for 6 people, it was just
astronomical.
You know, and we very rarely fly now. And first of all, I think you have to good reason to fly, right?
Yeah.
And that felt like a very good reason to fly. And I just couldn't do it. Couldn't justify it. As much as I wanted to be there.
Yeah.
But just too costly.
Too costly.
You know, it's families, right, Grace? You don't have a family.
Yeah.
So that's a big change since the last time we were behind those mics. And it was me guesting on your podcast then, State of Mind, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So go check out Grace's podcast there, State of Mind. Look around 2019. You'll hear.
Somewhere around there. But interestingly, I feel like that conversation was probably, I didn't really know you as I know you now then.
Mm.
So I imagine we probably just talked about, you know, who is Tony? What does Tony do? And, you know, going through all the kind of natural lifestyleist stuff. Whereas I feel like now, if we were to have a conversation, we are having a conversation.
We are, yeah.
We'd probably end up talking about very different things.
Well, it's nice. It feels much more like a chat rather yeah. than what was more interview type back then.
Mm.
We still covered some great subjects. We got into the whole melatonin, I believe, and amber glasses and all that stuff that feels like it's so much more mainstream now.
Yeah.
But back then we were like,
We were trailblazing.
I
know.
Yeah,
we were trailblazing. Yeah, I'm a big fan of those. I always wear my blue blockers in the evening. I've got daytime blockers now that I wear when I'm doing screen work.
Get to that. Like, yeah. What's your thoughts on that? Because there's a whole, I mean, obviously when you're outdoors, you're not wearing those. You need those off, right? But totally. When you're on the screen, as in just that visual kind of.
Yeah. So I'll backtrack and just explain to everyone. I'm a nutritional therapist.
Well, I was going to do that in the intro, but yeah, you go. Grace is going to do her own intro now, so go.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Grace Kingswell.
Simon, I don't need to record an intro now. You won't be waiting on me for weeks.
As Tony has probably said, I'm a nutritional therapist and everything that kind of entails, really. And nutrition is a very small part of what we do. So things like circadian rhythms and wearing blue blockers and telling people to not wear shoes and go and ground their feet is all really part of my world as much as it is yours.
Mm.
So there's a lot of crossover there. And I've been looking a lot around the light piece recently. I'm doing a master's at the moment, which is good, but also I don't know why I'm doing that with a 19-month-old. I think that was brave of me. Maybe to use that word, it's been a lot. But I was researching recently for a research proposal for my dissertation, for a study that I would run looking at sleep quality and wearing blue blocking glasses,
mm-hmm.
something nice and simple. And I was just got myself some daytime blue blockers in the process because obviously you need to be wearing red lenses at nighttime as soon as the sun goes down.
Yeah.
As I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast knows.
Well, there's a period of time from sundown, right?
Yeah.
So there's that, the hue would shift. So if you were on the equator, like looking at the indigenous studies, because that's really where the real templates are of how it is in nature versus the weird studies, the Western educated, industrial rich, democratic studies, which is like 15% of the population, but we get hit with that.
Yeah.
So looking at the indigenous cultures, it's not like 6 p.m. it's dark.
No.
And therefore, but they... You know, there's a transitioning period where the light changes.
Right? And those wavelengths are crucial.
Yeah.
That those transition periods, you know, first thing in the morning, last thing at night, as it's rising, as it's going down, you can look directly at the sun during that time.
Fuck, Grace, we're straight in.
Yeah. That's when you can get that, you know, infrared, near infrared. You should be exposing as much of your skin at those times of day. So like naked in your garden first thing when no one can see you. I don't really do that in the evening, but I go out and I have a shower first thing in the morning when the sun is coming up. Anyway, so you get out at those times of day that primes the skin to be able to better tolerate sunlight at midday. So that's one way to not burn as easily, you know, building up that tolerance with those specific wavelengths at sunrise and sunset. But the daytime blue blockers are great if you're someone that's spending a lot of time indoors in an indoor environment in front of a screen because they filter out some blue and green wavelengths, but not all, because obviously we need some blue light, that particular wavelength, so that the body knows it's daytime, ultimately. But even, I think it's like not that long ago, you know, we're talking really quite recently that we swapped over from incandescents to LEDs.
Yeah, because the lux, even the studies, because I was looking at, you know, it's gone from what was 600 lux would inhibit that melatonin to something like 60 lux.
Yeah.
And that only transition in that time is just the change in the bulb and the direction of those bulbs and how the retina picks it up, right? That signals that suprachiasmatic nucleus to say lights on, lights off.
Lights on, lights
melatonin
off.
Melatonin on, melatonin off, right?
And what people don't realize is that melatonin is actually made in the morning. So that's why you know, part of everybody's prescription, so to speak, should be morning light. Mm. Because you make that melatonin, then you then store it throughout the day, and it's the signal to start releasing it is the sun going down. Yeah. So then when you don't get that signal because the sun goes down and you're still looking at your screen, or you've got LED lights on in your house or whatever, then it doesn't get released. So, and obviously melatonin is important for sleep, but it's also very potent antioxidants. It's there's some really interesting research, actually. Sorry, I'm deviating now. Looking at vitamin D as the new melatonin, because actually vitamin D has this circadian rhythm as well, and the two work kind of together. It's really fascinating. It's a paper by Deanna Minich, I think.
Well, again, that'd be interesting to see, because that brings in cholesterol as well, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Sunlight synthesizing cholesterol to get to D3, right? Is that right?
Totally. So you make... when your skin is exposed to sunlight, you convert cholesterol into vitamin D, but you convert it into usually storage, and then when the body needs active forms of vitamin D, like in the winter months, it will do that conversion. So that's super interesting, because I think, so when you go and have a vitamin D blood test, we're not actually measuring the active form as such.
We're measuring the stores.
Yeah. So we've got this number of like 75 that, you know, everyone should be over 75. You go to your GP, you have your vitamin D blood test, you're under 75, they say, here, take some vitamin D. I'm quite against vitamin D supplementation, because I think if we could actually measure active, you know, what's going on in the body, we'd see a totally different picture, because that mechanism is really tightly controlled. When the body senses that it needs it, will convert from storage.
Mm.
So taking a supplement is disrupting that feedback mechanism.
Well, it's a bit like taking melatonin. It's disruptive of that, your own melatonin production, right?
And vitamin D is ultimately, it's more of a hormone. It has a hormonal action in the body. It's not a vitamin in the same way that vitamin C, vitamin K are. So, and hormones are so tightly regulated in the body that personally, in my clinical practice, I don't mess around with it too much. If someone does have really low vitamin D on testing, I will tell them, they need to consume foods that contain vitamin D and get skin in the game, ultimately. And if they have high cholesterol, they need to sunbathe.
Well, this is it, isn't it? So if you look at that whole bigger picture, it's like, I'm an indoor species. I spend 95 to 99% of my time indoors, bathed in artificial light that isn't bright enough in the morning to start those cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you look at the lux inside, even with this great big bright light that Simon's introduced, what, it's like 2,000 lux, you might say, within a room. Whereas even on a cloudy day, where are we at? What is it? Like 10,000 lux?
So, something like that.
And you need that potency. And then, so that's going to then help that cycle already of melatonin, which could say dumping out sleepy hormones and dumping out the sleepy hormones in the morning, but to then start that cycle again. And then being out in the sunlight to then lower cholesterol and build that bank of D3.
Yeah.
So I'm missing out on all of that by being an indoor species.
Yeah.
And we question it somehow. And it's like, well, it's obvious, isn't it? It's like for 95% of our existence, that's our biological normal template.
Yeah.
Right? Anything outside of that is an extreme to that biological system, right?
Mm. And that cholesterol piece seemed to come up with so many people. I mean, it's the kind of number one question I get on my Patreon page is, I've been told I have high cholesterol. What should I do about it? Or I'm of a certain age, I've been told I have high cholesterol, they want to give me a statin, what should I do about it? And it's really hard because, again, cholesterol is very, very complicated. I don't even understand the intricacies as much as I should. But one thing I do know is that oftentimes we're just being told what our total cholesterol is, which is not good enough, because actually we need the ratio between the different types. We also need the particle sizes. And also, don't just give me your cholesterol levels. Tell me what you're doing vitamin D wise. Like, how are you there? Because we can't negate that interplay. And unfortunately, the advice still is, oh, well, you need to reduce saturated fat. Well, that's nonsense, because we also know that dietary saturated fat and dietary cholesterol does not equate to serum cholesterol on testing. It doesn't work like that. The body makes cholesterol itself every single day. We have endogenous cholesterol production because it's so important for so many functions.
It's a precursor for our hormones, right?
Builds all the hormones.
Yeah.
When you look at that hormonal cascade from cholesterol, we get everything.
Like pregnenolone.
Pregnenolone, DHEA. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you look at that on Dutch testing, which is like a urinary hormone dried hormone testing that we do a lot in functional medicine. And almost always something is not right there with the hormones. And the easiest way we can impact better hormonal function is, yeah, living a bit more naturally.
So again, it's like unpacking the weird versus the wild, I guess, right?
Yeah.
The wild and the weird, because again, it's like, right, natural light, precursor for hormones, hormonal disruptors by not being bathed in sunlight, right?
Yeah.
Melatonin, so your sleep cycles affect that. Light, of course, can affect the sleep cycles, plus that melatonin. And then the repair system that melatonin has within that as well.
Yeah.
Versus, again, an indoor species and then taking medication to deal with the symptoms of being an indoor species.
Mm. Yeah.
You know?
It's really hard because, unfortunately, life is a lot indoors in this country in winter that we're just coming out at the end of. You know, you can still go outside whenever you want to go outside, but it is harder. Like, we can't deny that. Like, it's tough. And
you have to play with the edges of discomfort.
You have to play with these edges, Tony, but, you know, sometimes you just want to see the sun.
I'm there. What do you think about, because I read some studies around the darker your skin, the more vitamin D you need.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, it is. And also, if you were born in the Southern Hemisphere, the less vitamin D receptors you have on your skin. So someone like my husband, who is Australian, suffers really badly with seasonal affective disorder.
Of course.
But he has never, ever had to work that hard to make hormone D because it's abundant where he grew up. Now living in this country, it's so hard, but he is, you know, he doesn't have...
So he has less D3 receptors.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So because of his, where he grew up.
Through that.
Yeah. Wow. Because obviously,
we
know when we evolved, we didn't evolve alongside aeroplanes. We weren't going to move countries and we weren't going to translocate our whole families and everything. We were going to live where we were born. And our bodies are designed to live within that environment. It's why, like, we've got to prioritize seasonal eating. We've got to prioritize that connection with our environment because it affects our physiology so much. Same goes if you have dark skin. You need like almost more sun exposure to make the same amount of vitamin D. But melanin obviously is hugely protective. It's important that we build that up in the skin. I know you're the same as me, don't really do sunscreen. Whenever I talk about this online, I get a lot of hate for it, but.
I can speak to it from someone that's would be incredibly pasty.
Mm.
Got ridiculed for being pasty, had ginger hair, pasty skin, loads of freckles. And if I spent 95% of my time indoors and the only time I was outdoors, I'd have be slathered in 30 SPF, which is a chemical cooked into my skin. How on earth am I going to ever build any protection to it? And then once I started to understand that, Rolier's work, you know, the heliotherapy, like way back in those studies, TB camps, that was the real breakthrough for me. It was like understanding what they were doing. They were wheeling these kids out onto terraces in the alpine forest and doing like increments, like 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and building it and building it, building it until they had this extraordinary base tan. And then the healing that they recorded through that, like these kids with TB were being cured, right?
Yeah.
Deformities even being cured because that D3 need was being met, right?
Because we have to remember...
Base tanning is the thing, right?
Totally. We have to remember that as humans, we have two energy sources. We have the food that we eat and we have light. And in that sense, we are similar to plants in that they use light to photosynthesize and create energy. We also can create energy from the sun.
Breath.
Yeah, and breath.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, we need oxygen. I forgot about that. Yeah.
Primary energy source.
But we forget that. And we forget our light environment. And we forget that we can actually download from the sun. Mm. And it's funny, isn't it? Because there's so much fear about burning. But what most people do is spend a lot of their life indoors and then fly to Spain for a 2-week holiday and fry themselves. Of course, that is going to drastically increase your risk of skin cancer.
Yeah.
But if you are really sensible about the sun and you expose a little bit and often, then you have endogenous defense systems.
Yeah.
Which is really, again, neglected. And
well, that
so
brings
so
it right full circle to the to the glasses conversation, or like the blue blockers in the day, right? Because there's that sensitivity, you might be able to unpack this, but with that Rolier's work, they discovered, like the results. They never got the results when these kids or the adults in these TB camps were wearing sunglasses.
Mm. Yeah.
So like a large amount of those receptors around the eyes, but there's also, it's, I think it's, you might be able to unpack this again. It's the way that the eye picks up the light will then increase our own skin's mechanism because of that light. Is that right?
That's exactly yeah. it. And you will, wearing sunglasses increases your risk of burning when you're in the sun.
Yeah. So what have we done? We've created like sunglasses becoming the thing in
yeah.
the sun.
Yeah. Because and, the sun is out to kill us. The sun is damaging.
And then becoming an indoor species when we're an outdoor species. Yeah. So the skin can't acclimate. We don't build a base tan because we're covered up completely throughout the day.
Yeah.
And for that 2 week holiday, we go to somewhere really ridiculously hot.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go out. Well, the saying is mad dog and Englishman go out in the midday sun, actually.
Mm. Right?
And then still wearing sunglasses. So then the skin's protection
mechanism. You haven't got the signals.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
yeah.
All of that.
Yeah. Totally.
It's great to hear. It's just, I think it's power that.
It is power. And I think what people need to realize is that there is the science there to back all
yeah,
of this
there
up.
Is.
And it's just human physiology at the end of the day that just so many people either don't know or have forgotten or have been brainwashed, you know, by slip, slop, slap campaigns and so on and so forth.
So you have a Patreon, right? You have a...
I have a Patreon where I do really interesting stuff, and it's my favorite thing that I do on the internet. It's a really amazing community of very like-minded people, and we have lives and we talk a lot about things that I don't typically tend to talk about so much on Instagram.
Like
vaccinations. I said it.
Got the big V word.
Like
out.
The way we are raising our children. I'm so passionate about that now.
Mm.
Being a mum, I've got a 19-month-old, and of course, you know, any nutritional therapist that has a child is going to suddenly become fascinated in childhood and baby nutrition and weaning and what foods we're giving them and all of that. So I'm really, really into that at the moment. And it's great. It's a really safe space. And there's so much information on that platform. I like to keep Instagram light, I think, and fun. And I like to show myself on there. I'm not
a
business.
Rather than trying to promote anything.
Yeah,
or
I'm not a business on Instagram.
In 5 steps.
I'm not the kind of nutritional therapist that's going to say, you know, here's 5 ways to do this, or here's what I eat in a day. I'm going to show you that my dog is really cute and that my son is wearing an epic outfit today.
Yeah,
you know?
I saw that. Well, at least he's got Vivos on, right?
He has got Vivos on.
There you go.
As do we all. But yeah, so I do that and I have the Instagram and I'm not really working with clients one-on-one at the moment. I'm doing a master's at the moment. I'm raising my son, which is full-time. I don't believe in childcare. So he's not looked after by anyone else apart from me, my husband, and our immediate family.
Those primary foundations.
Primary foundations. And also, not that I think any of us should take podcasts as scientific evidence, because we all need to do our own research, but I listened to a fantastic episode on the link between childcare and ADHD,
yeah.
of which there is a bit of a epidemic in mm-hmm. in our youth
yeah.
at the moment, and how that they can kind of affect each other. You know, those like foundational early years. And I just thought, I'm in a position where I don't have to send him anywhere. I work for myself, so I can just not work right now. And, you know, life's a bit leaner and a bit tougher on us. But
the sacrifices
I want to do that.
Make, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're the same. So we unschooled all the kids and we don't have lavish holidays, and our primary kind of expenditure is really food.
Food.
We want to just nourish the kids the best we can. I'd choose that over any expensive holiday or travel anywhere.
Yeah.
And it is a sacrifice. And at the very beginning, we were like proper broke to be able to do
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah.
Know? I joke about it, you know, that we were a ground living family and we were very, very minimalist.
You people couldn't afford any furniture.
Couldn't afford any furniture.
No. I said to Nick the other day, I was like, do you know how much bigger this room would feel if we didn't have the sofas? He was like, no, I'm not ready. Stop. Stop right there.
But it is. It's the sacrifice, right? But
it
it's
is.
Great. I mean, hats off. And also, because I get hit with this in my DMs on socials. It's like, oh, it'd be so good to hear more from your wife about her lifestyle and what she does and what she does with the kids. And Catherine just doesn't want to be on Instagram. Mm. She's not interested. She'd rather put that energy into actually the kids and family life.
It's full on.
But it is great for women to see this natural lifestyle playing out in a natural parenting method and with the food and nutrition and also looking at sleep and all of that from someone that is also running their business.
Yeah.
You know, because there can be that. It's like, it's either this or this. Yeah. And actually you can.
You can do both, but you have to change. You have to adapt. And what I realize is that I can't do one-on-one stuff right now because it's so time consuming.
But then you're studying a master's.
I'm studying a master's.
You know, so if that was the job.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that's huge.
And I'm kind of getting through that. I'm not doing as much as I maybe would like to. And I think, you know, back in the day, I studied at Cambridge. I was a high achiever at school. Like I'm very used to working hard in that sense. And it's interesting because the last time I was doing this kind of level of academic learning, I could be 100% selfish with my time and I could do as much as I wanted. And now it's like, okay, I think that's good enough. Moving on to the next question.
How does that feel?
It's been an adjustment, totally, but it's been very freeing because very liberating. I know I'm doing well enough to pass assignments and that's fine because Jude is way more important. And I'm sort of doing the master's to tick a box. It gives me a particular qualification that I want. And after I've done that, I will go on my way. And what I'm focusing a lot more on is the kind of group work stuff, trying to bring out a program. It's kind of half written, called Beyond the Breast, Foundations of Food for Families and Children. Because every mother I speak to is, well, not every mother, but so many mothers and families are grappling with things like eczema or picky eating or skin rashes or babies spitting up, reflux. And we don't have the answers.
Teething.
We don't have the answers for that.
Like when you unpack it, it's fascinating.
Yeah, I listened to you guys talk about that on, I can't remember who's, was it your podcast?
With Katerina. Yeah, Katerina was here. We got behind the mics. Because we were obsessed by GAPS at one point, you know, gut and psychological syndrome.
So this is the interesting thing. So this course of mine is largely based on that. Mm. However, as a UK nutritional therapist regulated by BANT, we cannot promote the GAPS diet. Because they make claims. It makes claims to treat autism in children and you can never claim to treat.
No.
So actually, when you look at it as a dietary model, it's fantastic for healing the gut, for working on root causes. And I put Jude on the GAPS protocol when he was about 6 months old because I started introducing solids and eczema cropped up. And I freaked out because I've had chronic eczema my whole life, not anymore. But from about the age of, I think mum said I was 2 or something, but I basically had it from then up until the last 4 or 5 years when I have been through this kind of healing journey. And I just panicked because it's just been debilitating for me and I've had all these chronic health issues. And I thought, that's it. I've passed on my shoddy microbiome to my son, even though he was born by C-section, which is annoying. But obviously there's my microbial trans.
Did you do a swab?
No, I'll tell you why the reason I didn't do a swab. When a woman's body goes into labor, the onset of contractions, bacterial species from all of the microbiome systems, the lungs, the skin, the vagina, they translocate and they end up in the vaginal canal.
Yeah.
So that when the baby comes out, they take a big gulp of your whole microbial makeup.
And the head
makeup.
Turns towards the anus as well, right?
So totally. So doing a vaginal swab, I would just be seeding with the vaginal microbiome.
Yeah.
And I decided that wasn't worth it. I also had a hemorrhage in the middle of the night and we rushed into hospital and had the C-section earlier than we were supposed to. So there wasn't time anyway.
Well, it's not even in your vocabulary at that point, is it?
There's huge microbial transfer via the breast milk. And me being me, I was very bloody minded about breastfeeding. I'm still breastfeeding. He's 19 months.
Bowman was up to 4. He stopped. Well, he made the decision at the age of 4.
Yeah.
I'm done now.
Yeah. So I will keep going until Jude is done. Although I do have a question mark around... so my husband and I have to have IVF because when I was 17, I had a big abscess on an ovary just randomly out of the blue. It was a cow that just moved.
Cow, did you hear that?
Yeah.
I thought it was Simon for a minute. It was like leaning over and I heard this.
It's empathizing with my...
Keep that in there.
My sad
story
that I'm about to tell you. Had this huge lump on an ovary, was very, very sick. and was in hospital for a long time, bit of a medical mystery. They didn't know how I'd got the infection, wasn't sexually active at the time. They were like, you just have this massive abscess and we don't know what to do about it. And then after that, I had an operation and they drained it, lots of antibiotics, off you go. And I think I was maybe a bit, I was 17, I think I was a bit young to kind of really listen to what they were saying. But I think my mum remembers them saying, she's probably going to have trouble conceiving. And then when I was 22, I had a routine scan that showed that one of my fallopian tubes was really infected. Yay me. And they said, we need to take that out. Because if any of that infected material then makes it down into your womb, then that is probably just like game over, you know, whereas you can take a tube out and still get pregnant.
Yeah, yeah.
So I went in for that operation, and when I woke up, they'd taken out both tubes. So I was infertile after that. No say in the matter. And that was pretty...
How did that conversation hit, like, with the 22-year-old Grace then?
Oh, it was a tough time. I couldn't really comprehend what that had meant for my life, because I wasn't thinking about having kids or anything, you know. It wasn't like I was in a long-term relationship, which swiftly ended, unsurprisingly. But the hardest thing for me was I knew something had massively changed in my body. I felt this like grieving for those little tubes. I wanted to know where they'd gone. I wanted to know, like, what happens to them? When do they get burnt? Like, what happens? I felt like I wanted to bury them and have, you know, say goodbye. And I also felt so different from all of my friends. Nobody could understand what I was going through. And it's actually only since those school friends that I still know have become mothers themselves now, I've had a few messages trickle in just saying, I don't think I understood what you were going through. I had a really tough time for quite many few years.
Yeah.
And my health just kind of deteriorated and just kept getting worse, really. Just all chronic issues from, like, histamine intolerance, you know, chronic SIBO, the eczema, chronic fatigue syndrome. And so I always knew after that I'd have to have IVF. And in a way, it's been a silver lining, because I think I would probably always have been someone that would have struggled to conceive. You know, the women in my family, typically my auntie ended up adopting. There's 7 years between me and my brother. He's 7 years older than me because it took mum that long. And almost in a way, it's good that I didn't have to go through that process of trying with it not working. And we just went.
The disappointment that comes with that.
So, when we wanted to start a family, I knew that's it. We're just off we go to the clinic, sort of thing. And me being me and I have a specialism in an extra qualification in fertility nutrition, I knew exactly what Nick and I needed to do to optimize egg and sperm quality. And the clinic were like, you know, they harvested 18 eggs when I went in for my egg collection, and they were all like double A quality.
What do you have to do, Grace? What do you have to do?
And is that, like, wow, you're so lucky. And I was like, I'm not lucky. We prepared for this for like 6 months. Well, it's all of the diet and lifestyle stuff, really. I mean, there's heaps, looking at male sperm quality in particular, there's so much research there on things like alcohol and toxin exposure, anything that heats up the testicles, saunas, hot baths, laptops on laps,
materials,
cycling shorts, materials, yeah. All of that. And the antioxidants are really important for men. You know, they need a lot of zinc. Every time a man ejaculates, he loses loads of zinc.
Melatonin then into that conversation.
Everything like that needs to be just sort of on point. CoQ10 is really important. And then on the female side, egg quality takes 3 months to mature an egg. So that's the minimum amount of time that you want to prepare for a successful pregnancy. And again, you're looking at nutrition. So I ate loads of liver, eggs for the choline, oily fish. I sunbathed every day, you know, did all these things, worked with all these modalities. And I knew that when we went in, I was going in with good stock. And we got it first time. So I think, you know, proof's in the pudding in that regard. There's heaps of testing that we can do, looking at sperm DNA fragmentation, for example. Vaginal microbiome is really useful if you're struggling to conceive. Looking at a full thyroid panel is really useful. Doing a Dutch test so you can see what's happening with your hormones. Are you estrogen dominant? What can you do about that? I think, you know,
and you as a therapist, if someone's coming to you, you can look at that profile for them.
That's kind of my area now, is the fertility nutrition side of things, and also then this like mother baby.
Well, I think also, Grace, I think it's someone that's speaking to it who's who's been through that process.
Right? Yeah, yeah. And actually, do you know what? It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. Like the injections, the egg retrieval, the putting it back in, you know, all of the stuff that goes with IVF. Yes, it's very grueling and it's not the way that I would want to conceive. And I think that there is some part of your body that knows that. But and for that reason, the other side of what I do and what I kind of tell people is that you've got to get into that fertile mindset. You've almost got to call your baby to you when you're going through this process, because if you're not seeing yourself as a mother, then that mind-body connection isn't there. Yeah. And even if they're going to put this blastocyst back into your uterus, your body has got to be ready to receive that.
Yeah, you don't want to be in a state of fight and flight where a baby wouldn't want to come into the world, right?
No.
It's like a survival mechanism. Oh, I'm being hunted down right now. Is this the best time to bring Bam Bam into the world?
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
But also seeing yourself as a mother. And I think that's very scary for lots of women going through IVF, because it's almost like tempting fate. Like if we don't get a positive result and it doesn't work and I've kind of got my hopes up and seen myself in this motherly role and everything. But I actually think it's the opposite. I think doing that helps.
The real visualization.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the down regulation practices again, like bringing in the breath and the calm and the mindfulness. And
yeah.
Also, you know, we were getting along that path, the microbiome, but I speak to preparing the physical vessel, right? So there's also, if it was, say, natural birthing, can I be in a natural birthing position for this length of time? Am I comfortable in a kneeling position? Am I comfortable in a squat? I'm actually preparing the physical vessel, because there's a lot of time there from making the decision, let's get pregnant, or maybe in the next couple of years, I might want to get pregnant. So there's looking at the quality of the microbiome, right? Because that baby's going to inherit that microbiome.
Yeah.
Then it's, can I prepare my physical vessel to be able to have birth? And not everyone's going to have a natural birth, but at least I'm preparing myself for going into that process and building the resilience, right?
Yeah. Even. And I obviously wanted a natural birth. And then I, Sod's Law, had placenta previa, which is where your placenta attaches underneath, like on top of your cervix. And once the placenta is attached, it doesn't actually move.
Yeah.
It moves in the sense that your belly is expanding. So like if you imagine you had a balloon and you put a black dot on that balloon and then you blew the balloon up, it would look like the black dot had moved, but actually it hasn't. That's what happens with the placenta. So if I'd gone into natural labor, we would have died, because he's just not coming out. Yeah. So I had to have a planned C-section, which I was really, you know, pissed off about, to be honest. But that's also part of the reason why I then started this work with Jude and looking at kind of what can we then do to improve that, because we know that C-section babies take years longer to establish a robust microbiome.
Yeah, that maturation of the microbiome, right?
Totally. And the fact that they are more predisposed to atopic conditions later in life, so things like allergies, eczema, asthma, hay fever, it really, really affects your child. And you know, the number of women that I know that have had planned C-sections because they just want to know the day that the baby's going to come. And it makes me very, very sad, because that education is not there around what's actually the optimal way for your child to be born.
Yeah, and they want to inherit your microbiome. And also, what, again, like going up again, that the hierarchy of that is, what is the quality of that microbiome that they're inheriting? But I guess there still is meeting people where they're at, right? So the women that do perhaps go, right, no, I'm having a C-section, or it is an emergency C-section, it's then, you know, what's the protocol?
Yeah.
What can we be doing after that, because it's happened?
Mm.
Natural birth might be optimum, but, you know, that wasn't an opportunity.
Well, ideally breastfeeding is what you would do.
Straight in.
And then the worst combination would be C-section and formula fed.
Yeah, Robin Shookan. Have you Robin Shookan?
No.
The microbiome solution. So her thing was eat. Live dirty, eat clean.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And she had a tick list of three things. And it was, give them antibiotics. Have you been given antibiotics? Has mum or baby been given antibiotics in that time, birth? Born by C-section and breastfed.
Yeah.
And three things. And the risk then, the height of autoimmune.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, mothers have women quite often develop autoimmune conditions after pregnancy anyway, because of the shifts in the way that the immune system is functioning.
Yeah.
Trimester one, well, you go from kind of TH1 to TH2 dominant and back again. So you're going from this more anti-inflammatory to a very pro-inflammatory state. And that can really cause, if there's, you know, that if the terrain is there for autoimmunity, then that pregnancy will can be the trigger, and is for a lot of women. But certainly, as you're saying, within the child as well, all of those things adding up to an immune system that's not competent at identifying friend or foe, a gut microbiome that's, you know, dysbiotic and not working in kind of synchronicity with the body. Then you lace on top of that a diet that's too high in sugars and starches, which is going to feed any pathogenic bacteria. I mean, when Jude cropped up with eczema at 6 months, I didn't let him have any fruit. I didn't let him have any starchy vegetables. I fed him on meat stock and things like pumpkin, roasted pumpkin, and butter and tallow and ground meat and slow cooked meat and eggs every day and fermented vegetables. And that's all he got. And you can do that when they're young because they can't decide what they're going to eat. So it's easier to really implement those changes.
And for them to become familiar with them.
For them to become familiar with them, for them to like the taste of liver, for example. And what you do when you do that is you're focusing on gut health, as opposed to let's introduce all of these different foods within the first year of life.
Yeah.
I wasn't interested in that as an approach. And he still doesn't have a particularly broad diet, actually, but that can come, you know?
Yeah, it does come, like all of ours again. So as our education went on, you know, because we introduced baby-led weaning and I'd look at baby-led weaning, I'd read through it with my lens of things like GAPS or looking at the evolution of the human diet. Yeah. When did this come in? Oh, so 95% of our existence was this. And then we introduce the grain intake and everything else. So that digestive system, let's get it back to that 95%. And that immature gut can't handle those foods. But in baby-led weaning, it's things like breadsticks and that digestive system just can't handle it.
Right? Yeah.
So it was for us, it was like put stuff out, even because we ground sear, it's just like put things out on the table and they just grab whatever and it's just available to them.
Yeah. And I look back at my weaning journey with Jude now, and there's definitely things I would do differently. You know, I was first time mum, quite nervous about it all. He was born really early. I mentioned I had that hemorrhage and we had to rush into hospital. They brought the C-section forward by a couple of days. He was born at 37 weeks and five, but he was only 2.4 kilograms, like premature weight, and lost more weight in the hospital because we struggled feeding him. He had a tongue tie that was misdiagnosed twice. And, you know, just could not get enough milk. So when he was getting towards 6 months, you know, the health visitor said, oh, he could be a candidate for early weaning. Well, I wish I'd just sat with that and checked myself and thought, what do you know about Jude? You know, look at your baby. Because as a first-time mum, you relinquish so much control to these health visitors or people telling you what to do. And I held fast on some things, and I'm really glad that I did. But I did introduce like yogurt and avocado, and I think he was having bits of banana and stuff when he was a few weeks shy of 6 months.
Yeah, really
but
early.
But really, he wasn't actually sitting up by himself adequately enough to be having that food.
To be able to grab it, even. Yeah.
No. So I would change that. And I think I was just quite gung-ho about, I'm just going to give him all the things and see what happens. And I kind of just introduced like lots of stuff. And then it was when the symptoms came, I was like, no, I've done wrong. I need to do better by Jude. I need to rein this back.
Mm.
Away goes the yogurt, away goes the fruit, away goes any kind of grain, and paired it right back. And honestly, he's just healthiest, happiest little boy. Seems like very resilient and loves his food. He's always eaten really well. So I feel very grateful for that.
Yeah, we had a guy, I think I mentioned it often on the Katarina podcast, the Katarina podcast, the podcast I did with Katarina, my wife. And there was a guy in the men's circles and he messaged within our WhatsApp group to say, my son isn't eating.
Mm.
And we can't get him to eat. And we've reverted to just giving him toast and pasta and stuff like that.
Mm.
And he's teething and his gums are raw. His face, all his cheeks are red and he's dribbling everywhere. And what can I do? And I think when it comes to food, we also get into a bit of a panic that the child isn't eating.
Oh,
and of course, we don't want them to starve.
I don't want them to be hungry.
Yeah. So he went down this path and he said, what would you advise? And I was like, well, firstly, how are you feeding him? He said, well, he's in a high chair. And I was like, right, okay, so make it much more playful. Take him out of the high chair.
Mm.
Because again, it's quite a forced environment where you have to sit in this alien environment and you're this amazing being that can move in extraordinary ways.
Yeah.
Put him on the floor and then lay out like stuff on the floor. And I'd look at this particular food groups, remove all the grain intake and stuff that might be creating inflammation in the gut, which then would be affecting his inflammation and his sensitivity. So therefore the teeth coming through are much more sensitive. It hurts.
Mm.
So remove that and then start to build on his microbiome anyway. And his gut health through this and looking at gaps again.
Mm.
And he messaged back, I think it was within 20 minutes, to say, oh, my God, that's the most he's eaten.
Yeah.
Just by putting food groups out on the floor that he could learn to play with and just.
Yeah. I mean, Jude eats most of his meals on the go.
Yeah.
I give him a plate and he takes it and he puts it in one location and he has a little bit and then he's really busy and he takes it and he puts it somewhere else. And it's adorable. But yeah, if I put him in the high chair, he's doesn't eat as much ultimately because he's not given the time. He just wants to play and eat, play and eat.
And that's the fitting into our schedules again, isn't it?
Yeah, you know? Totally. Because we still have tables and chairs in our house. So he sees us sitting at the table.
Are you listening, Nick? Are you listening?
Yeah.
We need to say so this is Grace. This is Nick's partner. And Nick did the music for the pod, right?
Yeah.
So the jingles you hear at the beginning, that's Grace's partner, Nick.
Yeah, I think super he knocked talented. That up in a, I don't know,
it was a quick
minutes?
One. It was. I was a bit dubious. I thought maybe he's just got that one in the background. But he put the video up of him actually strumming away.
He's a very talented man.
Super talented.
And I'm always in awe of him that he's managed to forge a career from doing something that he's so good at and that is so unstable in so many ways. You know, he's earned a living from music since he was 19.
Mm.
And I just think that that's amazing that he supports me and Jude with his own music that he writes. You know, he's not out there playing cover gigs or like singing at weddings. He is a songwriter and he earns money from that. I just think it's
singer-songwriter.
Really admirable. Yeah.
Is it a songwriter-singer?
Anyway. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't ask me. We actually met when he was busking on Portobello Road and I sidled up to him and just leaned in and said, you know, I'm probably a better singer than you. And I walked off and that's how we met.
Did he run after you?
Yeah, he did.
He did.
And to this day.
Bashed you on the back of the head of his guitar.
I stand by that statement. No, I was running.
I heard you sing the other day. I think you were on, was it on socials you were singing the other day?
So
I'm sure it was.
Yeah, you. It was. I'd put a funny clip. I was a choral scholar at Cambridge, and before that, you know, just a lot of classical, like a lot of singing, but also, you know, other stuff. And I was playing with a band in London when I met Nick, and we were doing a few gigs, like original songs and things like that. And I was working in fashion, and I was running this pop-up shop on Portobello Road, and there's that spot on Portobello where they always have the buskers, and typically they are so bad. Like there's a guy that wears one flipper, and he's always half drunk and he's, you know, whatever, terrible.
Yeah.
And then one day there was this attractive Australian man with long hair and lots of muscles and he was playing and singing. He was really good.
Who was that then?
Oh, Tony.
It's you, Nick. I know.
So us girls that were working in the shop kind of looking out like, oh, who's that? And I think we maybe had chatted a couple of times before I told him that I was a better singer than he was. And just one day he was playing and I just thought, I think I was feeling very confident at the time. I'd been living in the Caribbean. I'd come back. I was all like very zen and tanned. And I just had this amazing time working, living in St. Lucia, where pace of life is very slow and everybody's just happy and friendly and dancing all the time. And I was like, yeah, I'm just going to tell him what I think. So I said that and I think he was quite intrigued. Since I've proven the statement to be true, obviously. And yeah, that's how we met.
Lovely.
Mm. And we gigged, when we lived in Australia, we gigged a lot together doing, at the time we were just doing covers. Waltz up to a place in Sydney, play for 3 hours and go home with $600. It's like the easiest thing ever.
But so nice to do as a couple as well.
Yeah, it was
like
good.
Like two creatives there, right?
Yeah, I think I was struggling a lot with chronic fatigue and mold sickness when we were living in Australia. Like my health was bad. That was the start of my main issues. And looking back on it was because we were in a really moldy apartment. I didn't realise at the time.
What, in Australia?
In Australia. So I found those gigs hard because I had to stay up past 8 p.m. in the evening and I was just on the floor with my energy and yeah.
The NatLife Pod is a platform for conversation to help close the gap between wellness as an industry and wellness as a state of being. This is also what underpins our online community, the NatLife Tribe. The NatLife Tribe is a growing health and natural lifestyle community where we offer weekly natural movement sessions, breathwork sessions, and hold a check-in safe space for the community to share, connect, and raise a hand if help is needed. This is a great space to embody the practices that we often speak to on the NatLife Pod. Full details on how to join the NatLife Tribe are in the show notes. I hope to see you moving, breathing, and sharing in there real soon. Should we unpack mold?
Let's talk about mold.
It's a nice little intro there. Love that.
I think it's becoming more people are aware about it now. I was talking about this with my friend Jade Layton, who's also a practitioner. She was on my Patreon last night.
Just up the road.
It's also now just up the road. And she is still working one-on-one. And whenever I get queries, I send them to Jade. She's fantastic. She's working a lot with more mold clients at the moment because, one, I think people are becoming more aware of how it can affect their health. But also, two, we are having so much rain and houses are really, really damp. And it's not okay for your health. Mold, when it feels threatened, releases something called mycotoxins, and us humans are kind of caught in the crossfire. And these can really affect, well, a lot of neurological stuff, because that's the first place, you know, you inhale these mycotoxins and mold spores in the nose. Mm. And then the brain is like a first area of impact. So a lot of anxiety, depression, brain fog, fatigue. But then systemic systems, because mold is lipophilic, so it loves fat cells. And what's everything made of in your body? Fat. So gut symptoms can be mold related, anything fungal on the skin, chronic eczema, histamine issues can really crop up. I mean, it's just
a mood food in a way, isn't it? Like depression, mental health as well, right?
Yeah, all of those like neurotransmitters, serotonin, all of that is affected. And it's a really hard one because ultimately you cannot get well in the environment that made you sick. So if that is an issue in your home, it's a very challenging one as a practitioner because you're ultimately saying to someone, how much do you want to be well? Can you move house? Obviously, there's heaps that you can do to support. First line of treatment for mold is always nasal stuff first. So trying to flush out, using like grapefruit nasal sprays, you know, antimicrobial elements. Binders are really important.
Do you recommend like neti pots or anything like
that? Neti pots, yeah. Great. A binder, so like an activated charcoal or like a binder compound that has other elements in, like the bentonite clays and things like that. You need a rainbow of nutrients. You need to be eating loads of fat because fat dilutes, helps to dilute. Mm. You need to be working on your bile. So bitter foods, bitters move bile. You need to be avoiding obvious sources of moldy foods in the diet. So grains. Grains are typically moldy.
Coffee,
typically moldy. Shout out to Exhale.
Yeah.
Peanut butter.
Shout out to Exhale.
Peanut butter is a big one.
Yeah.
There are some companies now that I've spotted cropping up that say mycotoxin tested, which is awesome. But also things like cashews can be moldy.
It's in to unpack that. That's the storage largely as well, right? It's
yes,
the storing of large quantities of this produce.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, but peanuts are not tree nuts. They're grown.
Yeah.
You know, ground level.
Legumes, not nuts.
Yes.
Yeah.
So avoiding moldy foods. I mean, it's a really difficult area, but it's one that is becoming increasingly common in my client population and other practitioners.
It's a challenging one, isn't it? Because it's not like we haven't had mold. So from my little delve into it, because I had a client that was a really chronic, she had chronic arthritis. She arrived like this, like hands and bags over her wrists to be able to carry stuff, and was really hobbling along. And then through I actually went down the rabbit hole with Walls Protocol with her and GAPS and stuff like that, and then movement, of course, and then, I mean, a massive difference, shift. It was unbelievable, playing pickleball, right? Being able to hold a racket and run around a court and play pickleball, right? From that to that. She's in the NatLife tribe, actually, Monique, beautiful woman. And from there, it then became Mold Reports. Yeah. She has a house in the US and one here, and she's gone down that whole path. And from my understanding, there's, because we have always had mold, it's the materials we're then building with and the treatments that we're using, which creates a mutation within the mold, which then we're not, our biology isn't so familiar with that. Is that right?
So lots of things to unpack there. The way we build houses now, they don't breathe. That's an issue because you have to be ventilating your house. Mold can't grow at under 60% humidity. So it's really important that you keep your house at that level. Heating on windows open is the best thing to do for mold. It's very unenvironmentally friendly, but that's how you get that airflow. And unfortunately, our buildings don't breathe. So, you know, these new build houses that you think, oh, this, I'm going to be safe here, it's a new build, the worst for mold. Sometimes the builders have cut corners, you've got a leaking window, and the moisture can't escape, it can't go anywhere. We're all drying our laundry indoors because electricity is so expensive. We don't have that much sun in this country, so we've got damp clothing, we're cooking, we're showering, all of these things are creating moisture within the house. Yes, we've always coexisted with mold, but we're spending so much time indoors
now.
Indoor
generation again.
As we were saying to begin with. And then the other thing is it's not the mold, it's what the mold releases, which is mycotoxins.
Okay, yeah.
And when you clean, the first thing people do is they'll see black mold on a wall and they'll go and clean it. That's absolutely what you shouldn't do. You should never, ever use chemicals on mold because it feels threatened and it releases mycotoxins, which are 100 times more damaging than just having a bit of mold on the wall.
Wow, that's really interesting because...
So you should not use bleach. You should not use these products that are called like mold killer or whatever. Yeah. Never, ever, ever. Don't go near them. So, so dangerous. White vinegar works really well, but I've also been reading a lot recently about even the water in vinegar feeds the mold. So it's so hard.
So what do we do?
I know, it's because
we lived in Ibiza for a bit, right? And it's famous over there, like the mold.
Is that because it's very humid?
It's humidity again. But also the building work changes. So the more modern homes, I think, are even more exposed to it.
Yeah.
And there's also what you see building work here, like, the buildings are left and exposed in the process of building.
Yeah.
So they have the whatever breeze blocks or boards or ply boards or whatever insulation is exposed to all the rain. And then they're going to put what plaster over that and then build around it. Yeah. It's no wonder there's going to be mold within those components. But in Ibiza, the cleaners would go in and they would literally just spray with water and bleach and leave it. And then they go in and wipe it.
Oh, those cleaners, I feel for them.
And then of course it comes back. And is it then a mutation of that again?
Yeah, yeah. I think in that building process, those materials eventually dry out. But you're so right. I always look at buildings that are being built as well and just think like, put a roof on or, you know, it's all getting wet.
Some kind of casement around it.
Yeah, I mean, our house, I think every house in Cornwall probably struggles with a bit of mold. Ours is not too bad, but I'm so hot on it that I am always looking at ways, you know, find out where the source is coming from. We had a, because I did a urinary mycotoxin test a few years ago when I was feeling really, really sick. And I had quite high levels of ochratoxin, aflatoxin, these that come from water damaged buildings, but the company couldn't tell me where. They were like, oh, these walls are damp. You know, we've put the prongs in and we've measured the moisture levels and we've done the thermal imaging and these walls are damp and everything. I was like, great, what can I do about it? But they didn't actually tell me where it's coming from. So it's a massive waste of money. So you have to be...
And that's not cheap, that protocol.
That's not cheap, but you need to be in a, like, you need to... There are companies that are much better to do that. And you need to... If you see mold, you need to be constantly looking, like, is it rising damp? Is it coming from the loft? Like, is it the window fixtures? Because the windows are always a weak point in a house. And in Cornwall, we have like 90 mile an hour winds quite regularly, especially where we are. And obviously that's going to drive moisture through the tiniest of crevices around your window or whatever. So it's so difficult. It's so difficult. But you need to think about, am I experiencing any symptoms? Even if it's a bit of brain fog, even if it's like low mood, if there is mold, they're going to be connected. Having said that, obviously some people are more susceptible than others. And this goes back to this piece of, we have had mold for generations. Why is it affecting us so much now? And it just comes back to this piece of, our lives are so much more toxic. We are so much less resilient.
The threshold is
massively reduced
over, right?
Detoxification capacity. Mm-hmm. Lots of us are undermethylating. Lots of us have genetic mutations that mean we have very poor detoxification.
Can we talk about methylation? What is that? I think that helps.
Methylation is it's also called one carbon metabolism. It's a process that happens all around the body, and it's just one of the things where you put things in and you get things out, and something that starts as something ends up as something else. And throughout the process, we're using certain nutrients, things like B6, as cofactors to turn one thing into another. And methylation is involved in detox pathways. It's involved in energy production and your Krebs cycle, the way the body makes ATP. Mm-hmm. It's involved in hormone detox. So if you're someone that's a bit estrogen dominant, you know, there's methylation playing in there. It's very heavily impacted when you have like an MTHFR genetic polymorphism, which about between 40 and 60% of the population do. And it's bound with this, with folate metabolism ultimately. So we need folate, we need B6, we need B12, all these cofactors playing into that methylation cycle. And I'm a really poor methylator. I haven't done a genetic test, but I'm pretty certain that I either have like an MTHFR or a COMT SNP. And it does make you quite a sluggish detoxifier. So you'll meet people in life who are a bit like Kate Moss, and they can party all night, wake up the next day and just be fine. I don't know if that's the case for her anymore. She's a bit older than she was when she was making headlines.
Yeah, maybe in her 20s she got away with that, but you know, 30s.
Or you meet people that have half a glass of wine or a hungover for 3 days. So we all have, we exist on that spectrum. And some of that is down to methylation. It's other factors obviously play into that too. But it's part and parcel of just the resiliency of your body and knowing if you're that person or not, and making the necessary changes. So I don't know, do you have any questions about methylation? I guess the reason people know about it is because of MTHFR.
Yeah.
And, you know, this whole thing with folate and folic acid. Like, we used to tell pregnant women to take folic acid. And unfortunately, the NHS still tells pregnant women to take folic acid, but we know that they should be taking natural methylfolate, because if you're one of that 60% that has a genetic mutation that means you cannot use folic acid in that pathway, then you're going to be at risk of birth defects. And this evidence, so this is the thing that bugs me about the way the health system works. So we know now from really robust evidence that it is safer to give methylfolate, natural folate, as you would find in your food, to pregnant women and anyone that has this genetic mutation. But because it takes about between 18 and 20 years on average for evidence in the medical literature to make it into our public health discourse, we are still recommending folic acid.
That's quite a lag.
It's quite a long time,
isn't it?
Yeah, really long time. And all good reputable supplement companies now have swapped to natural folate. And I think that's evidence enough, isn't it?
So, I mean, how far in are we of that 20 years?
It's quite recent research. I don't know exactly off the top of my head, but I would say it's not going to be like in the next few years that they change that guidance. And there are obviously contraindications with using natural folate. Sometimes it can make people very anxious, and can exacerbate things like depression. But on balance, the evidence is that it's especially for pregnant women, is much safer to be given folate.
From a safety perspective, yeah.
Yeah. So it's mad that, you know, even things like Pregnacare, which is a multivitamin, pregnancy multivitamin, it's mad that they even exist.
And a big brand.
Like, the forms of the nutrients in that supplement are so bad.
Are we going to get in trouble, Grace, with Pregnacare, like Oatly?
Well, I'm not adverse to big companies coming at me, as you mentioned. Yes, Oatly.
I can't have you on air and not talk about oat milk, right?
Okay. So I put a podcast out many years ago now called The Problem with Porridge. No, sorry. That was the whole blood glucose thing. That was another
thing. Let's get to that after. Yeah.
I do have a big issue with porridge, and I have a big issue with parents giving their children porridge for breakfast. No, this one was called The Problem with Plant Milks. That's right.
Yeah.
And in that episode, we discussed plant milks and the issue with seed oils, ultimately, which is very contentious. And these days, it's so contentious. When I put that episode out, it was like, what are seed oils? And we talked a lot about Oatly because it's the biggest company that does oat milk over here. It's in all of the cafes. It froths the best
it's
for coffee.
It's
delicious
barista's
and
favorite.
Sweet and yummy. And people don't like it when you challenge something that they love, it turns out. And yeah, we got a massive backlash on that, but also a huge amount of support from people understanding finally that actually I should be reading the label. I should be understanding why I should not be having rapeseed oil in that capacity, in that milk. And yeah, Oatly got in touch and they were like, basically, we think you're wrong and here's the reasons why. And I chatted to them about it and I said, look, here's the evidence. You shouldn't be putting these oils in your milks. And they kind of missed the point. They were like, yes, but you know, rapeseed oil has a really high smoke point. It's really safe, blah, blah, blah. And it's just nonsense. You know, you have to look at the actual structure of these fats. A saturated fat is saturated with, you know, the carbon and hydrogen atoms in that molecule cannot move because all of the bonds are saturated. In an unsaturated fat or polyunsaturated fat, you have these double bonds, which can change and means that the structure, so because each bond isn't saturated with something, when it gets heated, when it comes into contact with pressure, light or oxygen, it will change its shape and it becomes damaged. And rapeseed oil in particular...
Safe, not safe.
Rapeseed oil in particular is contentious because actually when you look at like a cold pressed rapeseed oil, it does actually have quite a favorable ratio of omega-3 fats to 6 fats. And that's good. So, you know, using a little bit of cold pressed rapeseed oil on a salad, great. Happy for people to do that. Heating it is another story. But then when you Google it, you'll see, well, rapeseed oil has a really high smoke point. But it does. It has a high smoke point. But that doesn't mean that there hasn't been damage to the structure of that fat before the fat starts to literally smoke in the pan.
Yeah, get it.
And the other thing is that they said, oh, well, we don't really heat. There's no like heating within the manufacturing process. Yeah, but what temperature is the human body operating at? 37 degrees. It's quite hot. So even just consuming that milk, there is an element of, and also the body is full of oxygen, oxidation.
Yeah, but you know, they are heating it though if it's in a coffee shop.
Well, they are. Like, yeah, exactly.
A barista.
Yeah.
A barista, not a barrister. Hopefully we're not going to hear from any barristers.
Probably will. But yeah, so I think people have cottoned on to plant milks not being the optimum. Also, just from a nutritional point of view.
I think there's also, Grace, I think being mindful of conversations because there's like reality bubbles, right?
Yeah.
You know, we're in a certain reality bubble.
So
seed oils, we know about seed oils. But not everyone knows about seed oils. And that's that point about bridging this gap between wellness and industry and an actual state of being.
Okay. So let me explain it then. Seed oils are kind of in all of our foods. All of our foods, even the ones that we think of as being really healthy. So like hummus, for example, will be made with vegetable oil. Any like pre-packaged pasta sauce so you can have all these really good intentions to go to the supermarket and buy really healthy food. And yeah, there's obviously worse things you can have than some hummus. Absolutely. But I think the issue is that they are everywhere and we're having so much of them.
It's that threshold conversation again, isn't it? Like with the mold, right?
Yeah. And that actually we're not able to then balance out these kind of unsaturated fats with which are very high in omega-6s to the more kind of omega-3 fats from oily fish and things like that. You know, people don't really consume that much of those and they push down a very anti-inflammatory pathway. We do need both. We do need both. But when I've tested clients' omega-3 to omega-6 ratio, I'm seeing like 24-1, where it should be maximum 4-1.
Yeah.
And that is going to push up inflammation because that's just how that's the action. And we all have enough chronic inflammation as it is.
Well, there's the oils and there's the grain intake, right?
Yes.
And there's also even through the meat industry, like this whole grass-fed to grass slaughter, there's also the grain-fed in that communication, mm-hmm. which means that the animal, if you're consuming meats, would normally be of a appropriate ratio, is more of an omega-6 animal now that you're then consuming as well, that then pushes up the inflammation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And even to the point of, you know, if we talk about something like blood glucose regulation, we can't equate the oats that you might use to make your porridge with the oats that are in oat milk, because the actual processing of those oats means that when that oat milk, you consume it, the sugars contained in it hit the bloodstream so much faster because they have been processed into a liquid. Mm-hmm. So you're not chewing, you're not activating those enzymes that break them down, you're not allowing the body enough time to mount an insulin response that is appropriate to the level of glucose coming in via the diet. So it's, you know, waking up and having a coffee with oat milk on an empty stomach, your blood sugar is just going to hit the roof, and then you're going to feel terrible afterwards, and you're going to need
chasing all day.
Where's
my next line?
Yeah, exactly. You know? And that's a big problem for our kids, because we are conditioned to give them fortified cereals for breakfast because they're fortified. So we need to give them cereals because they're fortified.
Yeah.
And we make them porridge, sometimes with oat milk. We put fruit on top of it. We might use some honey. They might have a banana as a snack 2 hours later. They might then have lunch, which is pasta and vegetables. They might then have like an oaty bar in the afternoon. And then in the evening, they might have some fish and peas and whatever. None of that sounds particularly unhealthy, but it's not provided any real density of nutrition, especially first thing in the morning. Mm. So first thing in the morning, we all need to be having protein and fat, and not only for our blood sugar, but also from a nutrition point of view. Babies that are 6 months old need more iron than an adult man. That's a heck of a lot of iron.
Yeah.
So if your child is on a vegetarian diet or a vegan diet, or just doesn't like red meat, or doesn't like any of the heme sources of iron, the bioavailable sources, that's not great.
Well, you know? Also, you can't get that in a cardboard box of confectionery that's fortified with it.
No. And ultimately, it just comes back down to eating real food, doesn't it? But there's eating real food, and then there's eating real food that's nutrient-dense food. So going back to these traditions of eating organs, making sure we're consuming egg yolks, pastured eggs, making sure our children are getting good amounts of saturated fat, which they really, really need, and making sure they're getting the active form of vitamin A via their diet, you know, not just beta carotene from carrots and sweet potatoes. Mm. It's just so much. Oh, I don't know. It really gets to me. I think if I could do one thing, it would just make everyone understand the value of a protein-based savory breakfast.
Help them.
Mm. Yeah, just put information out there that makes people question what they've been told or what they assume to be right about the world. You know, we all need to keep constantly learning and evolving. And I think one of the big problems is that we don't listen to our bodies that much anymore. You know, you, Tony, are your own best doctor. I am my own best doctor. Nobody knows my body like I do. Try a savory protein-based breakfast every day for 7 days. You can do anything for 7 days. See how you feel. Proof is in the pudding.
I think equally, if you're a parent, just do that for your kids.
Yeah.
Because me as Tony kid,
toast, cereal.
No, it's worse. Well, my cereal, yeah, but my dad used to work just his balls off, and he had a business, and we really just got to see him briefly, I would say. And my mum ran a bakery, and she'd be out the house like at 5 a.m., like super early. And we kind of had like our own kind of breakfast thing going on, like me and my sister and I, and we'd just make our own stuff. And there'd be Weetabix out on the table and a big bowl of sugar and milk.
Mm.
And I used to put 3 Weetabix in a bowl, and I used to cover it with milk just to the level so you could just see the top of those Weetabix crowning.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to get ladles of sugar, right? I'm talking like tablespoons of sugar, sprinkle it over the top until it created like a thick layer of sugar.
Yum.
On my Wheaties. I mean, it was fucking
I do remember that about childhood.
But I was like a kid on kiddie cocaine. Yeah. I mean, I was so out of my head. And all my symptoms, I could actually say my school report, my school grades, my fights, my crime behavior, my drugs coming into my early teenage years in school, all of the stuff was driven, I would say, by that crazy kiddie crack cocaine morning that I was having.
And they tell us that we have
totally out of control.
An ADD epidemic.
Yeah, but I was
that
kid, right? Yeah. And but it wasn't labeled as that then.
Yeah.
You know, you were just you're a problem kid or you're something. And I would literally be like out the window, tapping and causing all kinds of mischief, really, until we hit a certain age. So I think, I think that's a really big conversation for parents. Like, even if you are giving your kids cereals and they're having that, or they're into their oatmeal in the morning and God knows, and whatever else goes on it, is to just have a play with that for a few days and see what the impact is. I've even asked your kids, like, how does that feel? What does that feel
it's
like for you?
Because sugar tastes delicious and we really want our children to eat. Like, we were talking about it earlier. It's we don't want them to go hungry. We don't want them to go to school hungry. Breakfast is the most important meal of the day. They've got to eat something. Oh, he doesn't want the eggs. Okay, I'll just give him a piece of toast. Or, oh, he can just have Cheerios again. And actually, like, it's very hard because I understand that. But I think if you can and you're listening to this and your child is young, start now, because then you're going to have this good habit set up. And if they're not, then just little tweaks to begin with. You know, you can have... you can have toast, but maybe ask them if they can have an egg first. Ask them if they can put peanut butter on that toast rather than jam. If they are into porridge, like slip some collagen powder into it without them looking. You can't taste it. You know, you can even put an egg in porridge. It's delicious. It's a bit like custard. There's all these things that you can do.
Oh, as in crack it in there, you mean?
Crack the egg
into
the porridge.
Yeah, okay,
cook the porridge, take it off the heat. Let it cool down a little bit, then put the egg in. You don't want to put it in when it's too hot. Otherwise, you get like the whites or scrambled egg and porridge. Not good. You know, it doesn't have to be like, right, okay, today we're having salmon and avocado for breakfast and like make it all really hard. There are things you can do that are better than just straight oats with maybe some plant milk because your kid can't tolerate dairy. We can talk about that. Then some banana on top with a drizzle of honey. You know, you could have oats with maybe they can have full fat dairy, or if they can't, a nut milk that's not, you know, that's going to be better for blood sugar than oat milk.
Who do you recommend, like a Plenish or something?
Plenish,
like
something like that, you know, minimal ingredients.
Yeah.
And then put some nuts and seeds on top of the porridge, add some collagen into it, maybe have a slice of avocado on the side, have a boiled egg as well. You know, a balanced meal rather than just, the issue is straight carbohydrates by themselves.
Yeah.
It's going to just be. And this whole thing about like, oh, but oats are slow releasing, you know? Oh, they're slow releasing, so that's good. It's really good. But whack a continuous blood glucose monitor on your arm, eat a bowl of porridge, they are not that slow releasing. You know, you have a pretty big spike pretty quickly. And the problem is when we stimulate that insulin response, so you eat sugar, you eat dietary carbohydrate. And actually going back one step, just to clarify that when I say sugar, I mean all sources of carbohydrate. Fruit, grains, legumes, anything that's not a straight protein or a fat is going to be carbohydrate. I think when we say carbs, people just assume like bread, pasta, rice.
Yeah.
But actually what we mean
is...
Or
sugars, right?
Or table sugar. So when you eat dietary carbohydrate, the body releases a hormone called insulin, which has the action of bringing blood glucose levels back down into a kind of resting range. And that is a normal physiological process. It's totally fine for us to do that. When we do that multiple times a day, so, you know, you've had cereal for breakfast, mid-morning snack of like an OT bar, lunch could be pasta and veggies, maybe some cake, you have some chocolate. Mid-afternoon, you might have like a coffee and some chocolate. In the evening, you might be having like a rice-based dish with heaps of lentils and maybe some fruit afterwards. You know, that is quite a lot of carbohydrate, and that's going to require insulin to regulate blood glucose levels multiple times a day. And when we do it all the time, constantly, you've had this like lock and key analogy, right? So insulin is the key and it's knocking on this door and it's trying to put its key in the lock so that it can scurry away glucose to where it should be stored in the body. So it's going to put it in the liver for short-term storage. When the liver gets full, it's going to put it in fat cells for long-term storage. When we are requiring that action of insulin all the time, it's like, nope, this key doesn't fit here anymore. You can keep knocking, but like, I'm done with you. And we become desensitized to the action of insulin. And that's when type 2 diabetes and things like that come in. It's not just about blood sugar, because actually it has an effect on so many things. It drives inflammation up, which is a big one. So it leads to something called glycated end products, which is like, if you imagine the topping on a creme brulee, that like crusty topping.
Or my Weetabix.
It's not, that crusty topping is not sitting on top of a delicious custard. It's not sitting on top of your cells, your organs. It's affecting the way that communication happens within the body in general. The knock-on effects for becoming desensitized to insulin and becoming insulin resistant are huge. So we can't, We need to start seeing the few symptoms that we might have of blood sugar dysregulation, like maybe your period's a bit all over the place, you're tired in the afternoon, you're having energy slumps, you're not sleeping well, you're getting anxious, you're getting hangry. We need to start seeing those as early warning signs of where could this go later on in life and can I rein this back in now? Because you can resensitize yourself to the action of insulin really easily. And starting your day with a nutrient dense meal that has fats, protein, and some carbohydrate if you want,
yeah,
should be actively encouraged. But unfortunately, we still have this very wonky food pyramid, don't we, where we're told that the majority of our diet should be those grains along the bottom of the pyramid, and at the top we have, you know, the meat and the things like that that actually we know to be very good for us. And I've just realized I've said something that's going to be very confusing to lots of people, because most of what we hear in the media is red meat equals bad.
Yeah.
So there's that conversation. But we need to kind of flip that pyramid and look at the good quality sources of food that we have and, you know, move towards those rather than the grain-based.
Well, when we're talking about the meats as well, where those studies are at and where they've been taken, like if you remove process from that conversation.
Yeah.
And you then removed antibiotics from that food system, and you removed the grain that could be creating an inflamed animal that could be turning that animal into an omega-6 rather than omega-3 again. So it's getting it back to a natural conversation. I guess we need to also, within this, is talk about the finances.
Yeah.
So like I get hit with, it's okay for you being an endurance athlete, and it could be the same. Like, it's okay for you, Grace, but, you know, I don't have the money to support that.
Totally.
You know, so what's the answer there, I guess, if we were talking?
Yeah, I think it's like taking an inventory of, you know, what, where do you spend your money and what do you prioritize? And then specifically looking at your food shop and thinking, okay, well, I'm buying packets of things like snack bars, or I'm buying really expensive. Do you know how much chicken breasts cost these days? Like if you want to get good quality chicken breast, like two in a packet, you'd be paying about £8. I mean, it's crazy. And actually looking to more affordable but still nutrient-dense things like the organ meats. You know, we don't eat those really, but they are like liver gram for gram is the most nutrient-dense food on the planet, maybe save for oysters. You know, making a bolognese where it's like half liver, half ground beef, for example, prioritizing things like eggs. You know, eggs have gone up in price, but they are still a really affordable source of a good quality protein. And you can do heaps with those. Leaning towards things like tinned fish, sardines, tinned mackerel, really beneficial. And just, I mean, I don't really make like recipes. So I'm never looking to buy expensive, odd ingredients that this recipe calls for. I'm literally just putting elements of food on a plate. So there might be like some fish, there might be some vegetables, there might be
yeah
some, I don't know. And doing it like that, and also making, like, utilizing soups and stews where actually you can make some bone broth or some meat stock with a carcass and some bones, which are super cheap, like a pound for a carcass, using that as the base and then using a little bit of meat that has come off that carcass, plus putting in some lentils or heaps of veg. That's a really nutrient dense meal.
Yeah, I guess we also don't need to go down the path, like, you know, I don't believe in killing animals. So I'm not plant-based for any other reason.
Yeah.
I'm vegan for a reason. I will not kill another animal or be part of that. How do I approach that?
Well,
what would you be doing in the morning? What would be a...
Well, firstly, I just want to say that I truly believe that if your health is robust as a vegan and you are firing on all cylinders, everything is good, no health concerns whatsoever, great. It's obviously working for you right now.
Yeah.
If that's not the case, then I truly believe that to be a good environmentalist and to take on that burden of how do we heal our planet, you can't pour from an empty cup. If you are chronically fatigued because your diet is not serving you, how are you ever going to go out there and be a good
environmentalist? Yeah, and what message are you putting out there in the world?
So
yeah.
Heal yourself
oxygen mask
first.
Yeah.
And that might be, you might have to change your diet because, yeah. If you are that way, and yes, I do have like friends that just don't agree with the killing of animals and that's fine, then you need to still be thinking about protein first thing. So using a plant-based protein powder in a smoothie that isn't packed full of bananas and tropical fruits, you know, looking more towards like good fats in there, maybe some berries, which are quite low in sugar, a good quality protein powder.
Nut butters,
coconut oil. You can still start the day with like a really good serving of protein and some healthy fats and some phytonutrients and antioxidants. I would do it that way. And, you know, when I have worked with vegan clients in the past, I don't anymore because I find it very difficult to impact any change. We have had to rely quite heavily on protein powders because when you look at the kind of plant-based sources of proteins, like the legumes and things, they're about 70% carbohydrate. So you've been sold a lie if you think that lentils are high in protein. They have some protein, but they also have heaps of carbohydrates. So if blood glucose dysregulation is one of your key issues, which it will be if you are plant-based, then it's very hard because you've got to consume those things. And actually, you've got to consume that lentil with, let's say, some brown rice to make up a complete protein anyway. You're going to eat a meal that's super high in carbohydrate. So then you need to go more towards the fats to try and balance that out. And the fiber, because that also really helps too. So starting your meal with a side salad, having lots of olive oil on it, then having your dal with your rice and things like that can be beneficial. But it is really hard.
Still good information. I think that's good information.
Yeah, it's possible, but it's harder. That's what I would say. Because you can't just have a piece of fish and some veg and know that, you know, you've provided quality protein with all essential nine essential amino acids. You provided omega-3s, good dietary fats, phytonutrients, fiber. You've balanced your blood sugar. You can't do that so easily on a plant-based diet. It requires so much more consideration. And obviously, it's easier just to have a piece of toast with nut butter. You know, there's worse things, but there's better things too.
Worse things, but better things.
Yeah.
Grace, it's been great having you on here. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Listen, where can people find you? Because you have the Patreon. I mean, this information's been gold.
Mm.
And we're only just scratching, really, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
And so you expand on this and unpack a lot more than this in your Patreon, right?
Yeah, allow people to ask me any question that they want and I will answer it, do my best to answer it. And it's a really lovely community. We have lives each month and chat. So that's a really good place to go to. And I appreciate any support there because it is a paid platform. It's £10 a month, but there's also about 3 years worth of content on there.
Look at the information they'll be exposed to, right? I think that's...
Yeah. And I think if you look at the cost of a one-on-one nutritional therapy consultation, then, you know, £10 a month.
Do you think you're
going
to go back to that work? A calling to it.
So what I would like to do, and I am going to launch hopefully in the summer, is this Beyond the Breast program, which is like a intensive course for parents and families to learn about, you know, what should we be giving as first foods. But it's also got heaps of information on why our kids have got eczema, what to do about it, allergies, picky eating, intolerances. Oh, they've been told they have a cow's milk protein allergy. What should we do? It's got all of that stuff in. It's got like my low tox living. It's got the weaning equipment I use for Jude. It's got heaps of stuff in there. That's going to be a really, really robust offering that's hopefully going to launch at some point. I would like to get back to one-on-one stuff. I think I'm going to focus on my family. That is my main goal. Finish my master's. Maybe have another baby. I don't know.
On trips back to see Nick's family in Australia.
Maybe move to Australia. I don't know. Yeah.
Just in case anyone earlier thought Grace was just jet setting off to Australia. There's actually family over there, right?
So. So that's like our one trip that we do, really, because we got to go see them. I mean, why did I have to meet someone that's from the other side of the world? It's really, it's tough. It's really tough. But who knows? We might go and live there. Mum, if you're listening, we can talk about this.
Yeah, well, you know, I think when you live further away, like Katarina, when she visits her parents, her mum now in Slovakia, that it's the quality of time then that they spend together.
Yeah.
It's a large chunk of time. And it's great for the kids as well.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I guess it's very different to the days of granny just being up the road and you'd walk up the road and pop in for a cup of tea and stuff like that.
I mean, I so want that, but I don't even have that in Cornwall,
no,
really.
I mean, it doesn't really, unless you're in a multi-generational kind of experience.
Yeah.
Maybe we're working towards that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe moving to Australia would accommodate some of that for the...
Well, it would. We'd be sort of 5 minutes from grandparents and family. But yeah, who knows? Anyway, I'm on Instagram, Grace Kingswell. I love Instagram. It's usually photos of me and my dog. I do. I love Instagram. I find I just find it fun.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a bit of a like...
Do you not get any moments in there where you feel like you're getting a bit upregulated? Do you get lost in it? Do you find yourself...
I would blow my own trumpet, but I'm so good at just like, I just on it and I'm off it.
Okay, yeah.
And we have a no phone rule in front of Jude.
Brilliant.
And a no screen rule in front of Jude. So Brilliant. We now watch no TV. And whenever, if I'm on my phone or if Nick's on his phone, we just check each other like, Nick, you need to put your phone down. And that's because I just never want Jude to see me prioritizing my screen over him. It is hard. It is really hard because, like, I just really want to reply to this message or, you know.
Well, it is in the entrepreneurial kind of sense of that because, again, it's not like a normal 9-to-5 in that sense.
Yeah.
It comes crashing in at all hours, but you have to have your boundaries in place, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I just think we know that it's just so, so damaging screen time for babies and adolescents and just everyone.
Maybe that's the next pod.
Trying really hard in that sense. But come and say hi on Instagram. I love it. It's a very fun platform. I don't share a huge amount of nutritional advice on there anymore. I do a bit, but yeah, come and hang out on Patreon if that's your
thing. We'll get it all in the show notes for you.
Okay.
It will all be in there.
Okay.
Thank you.
High five.
We're going to have a hug. You all right hugging?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's have a hug. And we take a long exhale as we do it. Should we do that?
Okay.
As always, I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you feel drawn to do so, then please subscribe to the show, leave a review, and don't forget to share. Sharing is caring. It really helps me to help others. If you're drawn to immersing yourself in any of the NatLife experiences or see yourself as a NatLife coach, head to tonyriddle.com for details of how to immerse yourself in the community. You can follow my adventures on Instagram at thenaturallifestylist. Big shout out to Simon from We Are The Clarks for producing, filming, editing. Much love.